Hello and welcome back to Brain Dump. First of all, big thank you everyone. We have reached the 3,000 download mark. So that's a big little achievement. It is a big little achievement for our little podcast. So thank you so much. Me and Monty worked really hard to get these out, so really appreciate all the support along the way. And thank you to everyone getting involved on the Brain Dump Facebook group. Loads of fascinating articles being shared, lots of opinions being thrown around, and I think it's great to just all bounce off each other. Yeah, thoroughly enjoying all of that. Let me know if you like these little rambles at the beginning. I tend to keep the ones at the end a bit longer for a bit more information. Anyway, onto this episode of Brain Dump, and we're lucky enough to have Yaz Wolf on the show. Yaz has been incredibly brave to share her experiences with anorexia and depression. I hope you guys can get as much out of the podcast as I did. It's so evident how much she has grown and the level of self-development she's gone through since her experiences with anorexia and depression. And she obviously has a wealth of information on the matter and so much experience to offload onto people. So thank you so much, Yaz. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Without further ado, Yaz Wolf, everyone. Hello and welcome. You're listening to
Brain Dump.
This is a podcast where we talk about life from the meaningful to the extreme. I thought I'd ask you some warm-up questions. So, do you have a secret hunch about how you will die?
Oh, wow. No, but I always thought it would be sudden.
Ooh,
I just have a, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I just feel like it's just going to happen. It's not going to be expected. It's not going to be in the hospice. It's not going to be anything that's too degenerative, but I think it's going to be sudden.
My God, I don't know whether that's good or bad, but I guess it just is what it is. Okay. When did you last sing to yourself or to someone else?
Oh, yesterday.
Really? Yeah. Oh, nice.
Yeah. On shift, there was all sorts of things being sung, and they sung, because it was VE Day, there was loads of people doing big celebrations. They were singing Stand By Me, and one of the patients started singing, and so we started singing when they started faltering off, and it sort of kept them going a little bit and getting really enthusiastic. So
Oh, cute.
Yeah,
I'm glad that you got some singing in your life. That's good to know. I think it's always important to sing.
Mm-hmm. I'm missing those long car journeys where you can just belt it out and then look sideways at the traffic lights and someone's looking at you like
yeah, just absolutely belting it. That's one of probably the greatest things about car journeys. And the shower. They're like the two most acceptable places to sing. Okay, and final warm-up question. Roles do love and affection play in your life?
Oh, God. what roles do love and affection? Oh, God, everything. That's everything. That's what drives people to do anything, right? Mm. You're either looking for affection or you're doing something you love, or you're reacting to someone else doing something because they love doing it. Yeah, I think it drives everything. I don't think I can give a more specific answer to that.
It's a good answer. Yaz, thanks for coming on Brain Dump. Just tell us a little bit about yourself to begin with.
Thanks for having me. So a little bit about myself. So I'm living in Bristol. I've lived here for like 5 or 6 years. Grew up in Somerset, so I haven't gone far. I am spending a lot of time outdoors, as much as I can, and I say that within the limit of what we have right now. But pre-lockdown, most evenings or mornings, it was spent outdoors, running, walking, hiking, swimming. There's some amazing outdoor swimming areas near Bristol, so exploring those. I work in support.
Okay.
I work with people, so everything in my professional life involves people. Everything in my personal life tends to not involve people.
That's fair.
It's quite a nice balance. I've just, a couple of months started working in a neuropsychiatric and degenerative conditions hospital. So I'm working support. So it's emotional behavioural support, striking a balance between managing the aggression and behavioural symptoms sort of following brain injury or comorbid diagnosis, and then also providing that next level of support so that people can access the rehab that they need or therapeutic support. It's very similar to previous roles, which has been support work, but it's a little bit of a step down in the sense that we're working within a wider system. Previously, it's always been work with charities or private work. This is working within a private /NHS hospital, so you're just a little bit more limited in what you can do. But yeah, on the whole, it's sometimes for some people, it's the act of just encouraging them to get up and face the day. For other people, it's accessing different activities and, making sure they get out into the garden, get some sun on their face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I'm currently doing.
Oh, sweet. And how did you get involved in that?
This one came about because I realised I didn't have any clinical experience. So the next couple of years, I'd love to apply for a clinical doctorate, which would allow me to then qualify as a clinical psychologist and practice therapeutically. As I said, I've been working in charities and privately, which hasn't sort of introduced you to how to work in a ward and work within the system. In fact, it encouraged you not to work within the system. That was the whole point of what we did. Mm-hmm. It was much more flexible. So just being around that and learning from people who have worked their way up there, learning from the nurses, the doctors that are there already. That's how I found myself there at the moment. I think my last role was absolutely incredible. I was emotion coaching. I was working with guys all over Bristol and the Southwest and London, but there was no switch off time. And I took it home with me, which was entirely on me. But equally, when you work within a system that's got no resources whatsoever, you feel like you're never quite giving enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted a role for once where I could, you know, I could go home and be home,
mm-hmm.
Which has been amazing.
Yeah. I bet setting those boundaries is really quite difficult, trying to help people, but then ultimately it is quite a big emotional burden at the same time.
Mm. Yeah, it's hard to keep those boundaries in. I think, you know, I genuinely love my job. I love finding out about people. I love speaking to people and listening to their stories and so on. That doesn't go away, that love, but you just have to change that role a little bit. Otherwise, you end up playing that role all the time and just taking on everyone's shit. It's really nice to sort of be in a place where I can put my roots in and then have those conversations without feeling like I need to play that support role. Mm-hmm. I'm actually just there as me rather than as a support worker or a coach or anything like that.
And you mentioned you wanted to work in a more clinical setting. Is that kind of the goal?
Oh, there's so many goals. Yeah, it's a goal because that's what I know about right now, and it's what has been suggested to me. It's what something that I wanted to do from a really young age. Whether it's something that I'll do, I don't know. I think the ultimate goal in the end is to maybe work in a space, an image of working within a space that's maybe in the countryside where I can work therapeutically and work with people that maybe aren't able to access a system or are not engaging with a system or are needing something different, needing a bit more flexibility, needing support in a different way and a different understanding. And I think that would be the ultimate goal. Mm. So clinical therapeutic work would be a way of getting there and understanding more about the brain and the body and all the current research that's coming out. Ultimately, I think I'd want to work outside the system and maybe provide a space that connects the two.
So what were your motivations behind getting into this kind of line of work?
Oh, motivation. I don't think I've ever be motivated to do anything else in the same way. It's been a question I've never really asked of myself. People ask it of you, but it's not something that I've ever needed to ask.
Mm-hmm.
It's just unknown. I've always, as I said, I love hearing people's stories. I think there's two sides of the coin. You've got the side which is I'm interested in people. I'm interested in finding out what makes them tick. And then I'm interested in maybe providing a second point of view and how that second perspective allows that person to access more.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I want to find out someone's story, but not for my own benefit. It's for the benefit of that person so I can recycle that, maybe repeat it back to them and tell their story in a way that allows them to see it slightly differently and mm-hmm. hopefully move forward. We do that all the time in our own lives. That's why we have friends. That's why we talk about our problems to our friends and so on. The support systems and mental health systems and therapeutic support does that, but just in a slightly more guided way, I guess. So I think motivating it is just providing people with what they could have in their general lives, but if they don't have that, it's providing it with a more guided system.
It's really healthy that we acknowledge the power of different perspectives. The more perspectives you get, you can then pick things that apply to yourself.
Definitely, and I think people sometimes neglect to speak about that as reading about boundaries and how when you work with someone you need to keep those professional roles going, which is very true to a certain extent, and sometimes you need to be flexible with those boundaries to acknowledge that you are really human as well. You're not there to teach someone something. They have all that knowledge already,
mm-hmm.
which is something I think you don't necessarily learn till later on. And it feel like that's something that maybe comes from our educational system. We have very much teacher and pupils rather than guided conversations and interactive conversations and treating everyone equally.
Okay, so you've had struggles with your own mental health in the past. When did this start? How old were you when you know started struggling with your own mental health?
Oh, a long time ago. I think, well, I now know it's a long time ago. I think you could talk about it from the first memories ever, but I would say primary school is probably when things started to, you start to realise you're a little bit different, maybe, or seeds start to be sown. And I think as soon as you start to interact with other people, that's when you start to realize that maybe the way that your brain is performing or your behaviors are affecting your life, maybe slightly different to the people around you. So at school, I was incredibly sort of bubbly and I loved going outside and I loved doing different things. The bit that I struggled with was understanding other people. I struggled to understand friendships, relationships, how to, build those. As that went on, it meant because kids don't reflect on things, and I was really open to learning, but kids aren't open to necessarily teaching you.
Mm-hmm.
So they just laugh, they pick on you, anything like that. And as we know, it can build and build and build. And if people aren't ready for that, they sort of take it on. So I think probably it started as early as that. And then moving into sort of later life, I think the seeds were sown. And when I was on my own, I was absolutely fine, generally. As soon as I came around other people, I think I hadn't detached those memories. So any friendships that I tried to form were always based around trying to form a friendship that meant that I wasn't going to be rejected again.
Mm-hmm.
And that manifested itself into becoming your own sort of critical voice of having that devil on your shoulder telling you, oh, you can't do that because then they'll reject you. Mm-hmm. Or you can't do that because that person will turn around and laugh. And that laughing at someone, I think, is probably what stuck with me the whole way. So when I was pre-teens, I started manifesting that into, okay, what can I control about myself? What can I do in my life to make myself that perfect human being that everyone wants to like and be around? And that about 12, women's bodies start to change, the people around you start to change a lot. And I started to notice that boys and girls can't change together anymore. Our bodies are different. There was a lot of focus on covering up, that we had to cover up in our towels and changing rooms, that it wasn't okay if you were flat-chested, that it wasn't okay that you had body hair. I had a friend who, at the age of 12, was told to shave her armpits by a teacher. Looking back, that's horrifying, but at the time, you don't know any different. You just go, oh, I'm learning more about the world. This is how it's meant to be. And so I started restricting what I was eating, started controlling what I was wearing, started looking for approval in places that I probably shouldn't have. So, and that then eventually led me, when I was in a school that was very hierarchical and very focused on excellence, just manifested itself into every area of your life.
Mm-hmm. That sounds incredibly tough. The need to be accepted by others, was that driven by a comparison or wanting to fit in because I can see other people fitting in? Or is it your own thinking of how self-critical, holding yourself to a particular standard?
I think it was very much the social side of it. So when I'm on my own, when I was doing my own thing around people that I was comfortable with, and that was a really small group of people, I didn't care. I've never cared. I've always been really laid back. I've always loved just having fun and having a laugh and not taking things too seriously. As soon as people were involved, I think it just took me straight back to being a kid and being laughed at. So it was that comparisons of looking around and seeing everyone seem to enjoy social occasions that then contributed to me feeling, oh shit, I must be different. There must be something wrong with me because I'm not enjoying this. And I didn't understand the reason I wasn't enjoying it was because I hadn't let go of all those memories that were, causing me so much pain as a kid. And you just don't understand that when you're a teenager, particularly with eating disorders. It's driven by something that's so deep. However, it's so shallow. It's such an easy thing to doctor in your life. To a certain extent, your appearance is so shallow, and that there's a comfort in that.
Mm-hmm.
Because no one can see behind that. Everyone can see how you changing, and therefore it's easy to get compliments about losing weight or what you wear or how you're wearing your hair. What's not so easy is to get compliments about kindness, compassion, laughter, all those things that you might feel are more important, but people don't compliment each other on that so often.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it manifested itself in that way because it was a really easy, quick fix. It was really easy to get compliments in that way if you controlled and manipulated it, which I, without even realizing, I did. To start with, not to a great extent in the sense that huge yo-yo dieting and huge binge eating, and then led to finally being able to constrict myself into eating much less, which at the time felt like a huge achievement. And looking back, that was the point where I moved into, okay, there's a lot going on for this person and she's reaching out for help, to this person's going down a hill that she's not going to be able to get back unless someone else gets her. Before, it was being managed at least by that little bit of self-belief that I had. Once I crossed over that line, I couldn't bring myself back out of it. I needed someone else to intervene.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like there was a compliments that you were getting on your figure was reinforcing this behavior?
Yeah. It reinforces it hugely. It's without even realizing the tiniest comment of, oh, you look great today, or, oh, I'd love to have a stomach like yours, anything like that, which is so innocent and so well-meaning, just is fed into the same sort of cyclical thoughts of, oh, that's all that people care about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. It's still the memories that stick out to me are those few people that gave those compliments really well-meaning, but fed hugely into that cycle. I think it becomes a point, and I think it's why people struggle to understand eating disorders, is it's like having another person controlling your life. You're no longer in control of it. The anorexia has taken over your whole body and your mind, and that anorexia feeds off those little compliments. It feeds off those odd words and odd looks and little bursts of dopamine because you've not eaten for a day, or something that makes you feel like you're in control. You're no longer in control of that.
Mm-hmm. That must have been incredibly isolating and lonely.
Yeah, it was. The whole thing was isolating and lonely. And there were moments, and there are amazing moments where people managed to reach out, and it's not the quite right words, but touch you, like actually touch the you, genuine you that's inside. But it was like putting up a barrier in front of the world. I think I was incredibly depressed at the same time, and that itself builds a cloud around you so that you can't feel emotions. So the isolation is inevitable, I think, because you can't feel any love, you can't feel any laughter, you can't feel any pain, you can't feel anything unless you cause that to yourself. So you go into a cycle of finding ways to cause yourself quick fixes to try and feel anything, which then drives you to do really odd behaviours which push people away. Mm-hmm. So you feel even more lonely, and it just, the cycle continues because you don't understand why it's not working.
Mm-hmm. From the sounds of it, you're aware of the barriers you're setting in place, and you're saying that it's almost like the anorexia is another person controlling your life. Were you like aware of that at the time, or is it more you're a slave to it? How is it that there's sort of almost two different forces there?
Yeah, two forces is a good way of putting it. I think it's a bit of both. I would never put the blame on anyone who's mental health has gone downhill. You know, they are doing the best with the resources they've got. However, finally having a doctor turn around and come under the criteria for anorexic, or, you know, you have depression, allowed you to finally be recognised for what you've got. And there is an element of feeding into that. And I think there is with a lot of mental health conditions. Sometimes people need to reach to a point where they have that label or they have that diagnosis for them to start to accept it themselves and start to then decide that actually that's not what they want.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost giving them a choice to go, okay, either I'm going to feed this, or actually I'm going to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that takes years and years and years to finally accept that you have to work really hard, and it's going to be very painful to not cling to that diagnosis anymore. But it wasn't within my control in that sense. It's not ever within your control. I think it's, you do the best with the resources you've got, and it's easy to look back and go, oh, I maybe chose to do this at that time, or I felt good because I was successful in being anorexic. But at the time, I wasn't trying to be anorexic. I was just trying to make myself feel happy in mm-hmm. some way. And that was the only thing I knew at the time that was making me feel happy.
In a way, it's a coping mechanism for some other trauma that you're dealing with internally, that sort of self-loathing. You mentioned this is all around sort of the age of about 12-ish, sort of pre-teens. Did anyone sort of recognise it? When did it start to impact the wider aspects of your life?
So for the first year and a half, I think people maybe recognised I was unhappy. Definitely the symptoms of depression were coming in earlier. In terms of weight, I think people just, you know, you're hitting puberty, weight changes, people change. I was shrouding myself in dark clothes so that people didn't notice I was either putting on weight or losing weight. At least people didn't necessarily feed back to me that they noticed. It wasn't until I went on a family holiday where I was really, really unhappy. We were traveling and we were in a hot country, so I could get away with eating very little. And I ate very, very little, which I think my parents were aware, but sort of also knew that I'd been really unhappy with my weight. So they just saw what happened and accepted that maybe I knew best. And I came back, and that's when the worried look started to come on. You know, teachers or friends would say, oh, you know, you've lost a lot of weight. I went to the GP for a different problem, a stomach problem. And that was the first time that anyone had mentioned to me that there was a problem with losing weight at about that time. But it still took months and months and months for someone to recognise. And I was actually, I joined CAMHS for and worked with a nurse, psychiatric nurse, for a little while. They then discharged me. And I, at that point, if anything, I was further deep than I was. I was just much better at hiding it. Mm-hmm. So I think it took another few months for people to really realize it was going to be a long haul. A part of that was the process of me starting to actually be honest about mm-hmm. what the problems were. At that point, I wasn't ready to mm-hmm. do that.
It's interesting that you mentioned that you were trying to hide it. What was the motive behind hiding it?
Like, I didn't know how to not. I'd hidden everything my entire life. I'd put up a wall my entire life and put up a fake face. So I didn't know how to be vulnerable and how to speak honestly. So hiding it was part taking away those coping mechanisms. You know, as you grow into being a teenager, you start to try and explore different ways to take control of your own life. Either it's rebelling, or, you know, it might be drinking, it might be having sex, it might be doing drugs, it might be just staying out late. For me, it was going and hiding the fact that I hadn't eaten all day at that time, because that was my own, that was me, that was my thing, and it was something that made me happy at the time. And also, it, although everything that the people around me did was for the best, at the time, I could only see it as they were drawing more attention to me and not listening to me. Mm. It was more examples of them not listening to the problems that were going on and just focusing on the problems that they thought I had, which in hindsight is probably always the case for someone who's dipping into mental health. You can't see your own problems mm-hmm. or your own struggles until you're out of it.
How did that impact your relationships with friends and family? You're talking now in a period of time where people are starting to recognise something's up. They're trying to almost take control of you a little bit, which I imagine would have been difficult. Did that put any strain on friends and family and things?
Yeah, hugely. The friends who've stuck around and the people that I know from then who've stuck around are unbelievable. Even the ones that haven't, you know, I'm so grateful for anyone who tried. I've got a particular memory of someone being cornered by two friends and saying, "We've got melon upstairs, you're going to come and eat some melon with us." And I hate melon for a start, but also, you know, I denied that, but it stuck with me as, okay, that was a sign of friendship. That must have been so hard for them to turn around and tell their fellow 14-year-old that they have to eat to have those ideas. But you keep pushing people away and you can't expect others to keep trying. In terms of family, I think it took years past me actually recovering until I started to mend those. My mum and dad remained pretty strong throughout me being ill, but then my mum had quite a large breakdown once I started to recover and moved out. And I think as she was starting to get iller, I was starting to get better, and that becomes all a bit tangled up because suddenly your problems aren't the only ones that are there, and it's not about you and your recovery anymore. And there's that little bit of you that you need that support still, but that person's not able to give it. Mm-hmm. So I think your relationships change, and it's unbelievably difficult for a parent of a kid who's got mental health problems, or any health problems actually, because you have to remain strong because that's what the child needs. But at the same time, if you're dealing with things, yeah, the relationships are just constantly evolving. I've worked really hard over the last year to try and build those relationships again with people and view them in a different light and try and hopefully rectify what maybe was slightly broken or damaged during those years. Yeah, it's gone well so far.
I'm glad.
I'm enjoying it.
Okay, so going back a little bit, you mentioned CAMHS. Is that sort of the first attempt at intervention? Like, what is CAMHS?
So CAMHS is the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service. So anyone pre-18, or at least when I was there, it was pre-18, who hits certain criteria will have access to the CAMHS services. There's quite a few different tiers, and for every county it's very different. My first encounter was when I was referred because of the anorexia, and I was also diagnosed with depression at the same time, and that was when I was 14-15. As I said, I stayed with them for 6 months, and that was doing sort of CBT based work. I was discharged, and then they eventually took me back in again, and I stayed with them until I was 19. So they actually let me stay on an extra couple of months because I was at the point where they felt that I could be independent, and I wanted to be independent enough afterwards, which was amazing. yeah, it's very different from county to county, and Somerset in particular is really under-resourced for their mental health. It's got some of the poorest services, not because of the people who work in there, but just because of the resources they're given. But predominantly it's CBT based, and then there are other therapies and other support available. They also did a lot of outreach work, which was amazing. So someone coming to take you for a cup of tea every week who's not part a member of your family and maybe is a little bit younger and someone you can feel comfortable with, that was just as effective in some ways as the actual therapeutic support.
Interesting. Okay, and you mentioned that you see you have the eating disorder, which is probably the most physically evident thing that you could tell that something is going wrong, but you also mentioned that that you were suffering from depression. Do you think the two were linked?
Yeah, I think it's interchangeable. It's, you know, chicken and the egg in that sense. They fed into each other. I think in terms of the effects, there's a huge, you starve your brain. The areas that are sort of newly developed in humans start to shut down first, the things that are deemed as non-essential. And those are the parts of your brain that are more reflective and analytical and allow yourself to process things in a different way, which is what you need to be able to keep yourself out of depression or pull yourself out of that. So the more I starve myself, the deeper I went into depression and so on. With the depression itself, I think that probably really hit full force when I started to let go of the anorexia and try and let go of that, because suddenly you have nothing to hold on to. And depression is all about sort of sinking into, or at least it was for me and for others that I know that have described it, is it's quite often sinking into a deep pool of blackness where you don't have to feel anymore. Because it felt so, so bad, but then you don't feel at all. And it's a cyclical feeling there where you're swimming, you're maybe trying to come to surface, but then you're sinking again because you can't manage it. So yeah, I think they were hugely interlinked in the physiological effects of that and the effects that had on your brain and how I didn't realise how I was driving those behaviours to keep going and keep going. Yeah, they were just feeding into each other. I think I had a huge sort of pattern of self-harming in lots of different ways, whether it was through eating, whether it was through harming my body, or whether it was through over-exercising. It comes back to trying to feel emotions you want to feel and not being able to, so that then re-impresses on your beliefs.
This all sounds absolutely brutal. For one, teenage years are difficult anyway, but how did dealing with all of what is going on in your personal life affect your school life and being a normal teenager?
In every way. So I stayed in school until I was pre-GCSE, so I'd been 15, 16. And I'd been in school, but not really been in school. And I was taken in to the office by a teacher with my mum. And they sort of turned around and said, I think the best thing would be for you to leave school. And so I did, although that was probably an awful, awful thing for the school to put out and to suggest when a child is ill. It allowed me to be free. So I didn't do my GCSEs and I went home and I volunteered and I did everything that I could to recover at that point. I loved academia. I could have done that for, you know, someone had sent me the books and the assignments, I would have done them. What I didn't want to be was at school. And then I went to college and I pretty much lived the previous 4 years in one summer, which contributed to a lot of fun, but also a lot of teenage emotions probably coming out slightly later than they did for everyone else my age. I did the basic exams, so I did my maths and English. I did them from home pretty much, supported by the college. And that sort of got me to the point where I was ready to leave home and I could get a job then and move to Bristol and away from that. So I think practically it was totally different. Mm-hmm. Because of that. Emotionally, I've done it in very different stages, but I wouldn't change that. I'm so grateful to have done that. Being out of education and out of that system allowed me to discover actually what I enjoyed doing and realize that I really do love working. I love exercising my brain. I love, you know, if someone sent me some comprehension questions, I'd probably grin rather than grimace, which is, yeah, mad.
For some people, literally, but... yeah. I was going to say, it sounds like hell to me.
Send them to me and I'll do them. It was really different. It's been fun because people react very differently to it and they just can't imagine it. They can't imagine having not been through those GCSEs and also how you can then do a degree and a master's and still enjoy academia. And I suppose it's just a testament that there are other ways to do it. Mm-hmm. I was incredibly lucky. I had resources. My parents were fairly well off, and that counts for a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, don't underestimate, particularly with mental health, what it's like to be able to go home and live somewhere that has food on the table.
Mm-hmm. Completely and, agree with that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, parents who maybe can't support you so well in an emotional way, but in terms of a practical way can support you, then it fulfills a huge need.
Mm-hmm.
I was very lucky in that sense. I feel really lucky to have done, really lucky to feel it to have had such a positive effect, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I think your journey's been a very different one, shall we say. Yeah, do you think that you were mentioning a lot about school and how effectively left it very early. Do you think school exacerbated your mental health crisis?
Yes. Certain systems. So I was lucky enough to be put into private school whilst when I was younger. That was amazing. I got to do sports and be in beautiful grounds and be around these amazing teachers who had the resources and flexibility to sort of really engage with us and encourage creativity. Once I got into teenage years, where ultimately teenage years are all about social development, that's what those years are for. We're trying to connect with others, we're trying to form our own identities from their opinions, from how we interact, discover what makes us tick. Whereas the school that I was in was so focused on excellence, particularly academia and sport, that got lost. Mm-hmm. For someone who didn't know how to connect or be vulnerable around people already, you just sort of fed into that even more. I think the schooling systems, maybe it's pre the secondary school that we need to educate people more and give them more tools to be able to deal with the secondary school system. Definitely don't think we're at an optimum point right now. I think we're churning kids out with so much less life experience and knowledge than they need. It's wonderful if someone can pass their exams and go to university, but what's more important is that they can hold a conversation with another adult and feel comfortable and maybe be able to talk about their strengths and weaknesses, or be able to talk about something they'd like to do next year. You know, understand about their own brains and how that drives their behaviours. That is more valuable than knowing every American president since the 1950s.
It's very true. When there is such a precedence on academic or sporting success, it is difficult for those social bonds to be developed when everyone is focused on academic achievement or sporting success. There is a lot of emphasis on being a somebody, whether that be in a good sports team or good at the piano or going to Oxford University, that it puts a lot of pressure on people to be those elite select few, that if you're not recognised in that regard, then you start questioning what your worth is. That was a very, very toxic environment. And, you know, teenagers, there's a social hierarchy that is really, really important. And I think a lot of teenagers get really caught up in that. Do you think that was an aspect in the trigger or exacerbated everything?
Yeah, I think everything you just said sort of hit the nail on the head in that sense. It was that trying to be somebody. You know, you talk about hierarchies and how important that is in that social connection. But within that school, that was all there was. Rather than encouraging community and being friends and learning how to do those relationships, it was learn where you are in the pecking order and where you will be in the pecking order for the rest of your life, as far as you were concerned as a teenager. So yeah, it feeds into a doctrine of the idea that people have a place, I suppose. It's that very traditional conservative way of looking at it, rather than looking at the society as a whole and how our years could be communities and how the people around you were the people there to support you, not to compare yourself to.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a problem with the schooling system or private schools or just this particular school?
Yes, yes, yes. All of them. No, it's a problem and it's a solution. It's probably reflecting a big change in our society right now. Mm-hmm. I think, and maybe this change has been coming around for 50 years. I don't know. I'm not a historian or a politician, or I'm not an expert in that sort of area. But I'd say yes, the private school system is, as far as I'm concerned, outdated. What we know from psychology, sociology, from looking historically, is what keeps people going. And oh my God, looking at how things are right now, what's keeping people going is community and families and connection, right? That's mm-hmm. that's all that people talk about, is how do you keep people connected. The private school systems and the systems that pit you against others do the opposite. They encourage you to be disconnected. It's a very individualistic way of looking at it. And not to say there aren't some kind of place for everyone in society. You know, we survive as a species because we're different and because we have different roles, but no one role is more important than the other. And I think that's what they forget about.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really important to acknowledge that we are very, very different, but it's our similarities that really bring us together and keep us together. Were there any particular low moments that really stuck out to you?
Yes, I have one particular memory. Actually, I have two memories, and I'm going to go back to sort of school time because I think those are the ones that had the highest emotional impact and stuck with me for a long time. I had a doctor's appointment or something. For whatever reason, I was late and people had sort of run up the stairs and were ahead of me, and I was at the depths of sort of my anorexia and depression at that point. And I remember trying to pull my feet up those stairs and it feeling like it took an hour. It took every single muscle, every brain muscle to move one foot in front of the other. And I just remember feeling like at the same time I was floating, and that really odd, disconnected thing of I'm here, but I might as well not be. You know, it has no massive significance for anyone else. There was no awful thing that came out of it. But I just remember that sticking with me and going, my God, everything is just gone. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not really here. Things like that is what I can look back on now and just go, God, that feels so long ago. Mm-hmm. It feels so far from where I am now. I feel so connected with the things around me. Whereas in that, I might as well have been a ghost.
Mm-hmm. What kept you going through controlling your eating? You're so depressed that you're miserable 24/7. How did you keep above the surface to keep going to be where you are now?
Amazing people like you, amazing people around me. I totally spoke about practical support, but the people who didn't give up, who kept in touch, who the members of the team at CAMHS who actually listened, who allowed me a space to talk and feel listened and learn how to speak. That's invaluable, learning how to actually say words and say what I mean. Yeah, that's externally the friends, the family, everyone that was around me at that time contributed something. Internally, as I said, when I was on my own, quite often I was okay. That self-belief, it's what we could never quite untangle. People would say I was underconfident or didn't believe in myself, but I did. There was a belief there. What I didn't believe was that other people would accept me for that. So, yeah, I think that kept me going. And I am a little bit different in that sense. And I fully embrace that now. That knowledge of being different and loving it when I was on my own was great. You know, that's what kept me going. It was those moments when I could really enjoy things alone. Yeah, I was lucky to have that mental resource. Mm-hmm. I think also I was surrounded by people who were practical and love being outdoors. Mm-hmm. And the best thing for someone who is feeling lost is to be able to connect with something, and the wind on your face or the rain or the feeling of grass or the feeling of muscles burning because you're cycling up a hill. That's such an easy way to get someone to feel something. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, everyone who took me out on a cycle ride or took me to the beach or gave me a really nice marshmallow. That's what kept going.
The marshmallows, essential. Good timing.
So good. And being a vegetarian now is the worst thing.
Yeah, literally.
I miss them so much.
Was there a particular moment when you realise, right, something has to change, a need to address something in order to get out of this?
Oh, so many of those moments. One moment where I'd self-harmed quite badly and my parents weren't aware to the extent of it. And I remember them knocking on my door, and rather than hiding, rather than saying, no, come back later, I just said, come in. And I think it was showing that vulnerability at that point. I'll never forget my mum's face, but how quickly she turned around and dropped into practical mode of, okay, we need to sort you out right now. We need to get you safe and you need someone here. Moments like that of showing vulnerability are the bits that changed. Later on in life, when I was sort of 20, 21, my partner from the last few years, we cooked a meal and he started serving it, and I was still holding on to certain behaviours, and it had lots of sauce, and this is not going to make any sense to anyone who, or it may do, people might connect with it, but there was sauce sort of poured over everything, and I had a bit of freak out, and he could not understand that. And I just realized that I can't possibly enjoy my relationship with this person who I love very much, and with friends and other people, if I don't let go of that. So those moments where I was trying to connect with someone or wanted to do something, and those behaviors or repeating cyclical thoughts were holding me back, those were the moments that kept me going, really. So I, yeah, there was no one final moment. There was no big point moment. It's every single time that I sit down and I have an ice cream and I absolutely love it. That's a reminder of, yeah, to keep moving forward, I suppose. Mm.
Amazing. It just shows how far you've come, that you can self-recognize so well in the moment. I think that's a really, really important skill for anyone, regardless of mental health or not. Yeah, that's something to really treasure. So what did you do or others do that helped at the time?
I think in terms of others, consistency. It was knowing that people were there, even if they weren't necessarily in contact, not letting me get comfortable. But I think humans do that anyway. I think meeting new people, people constantly challenging you, and people being genuine in themselves. I surrounded myself with people who have really thrived on being themselves and following what they love and finding out more about themselves and self-reflecting. And I think being around people like that is inspiring. So sort of looking back, I just feel like building a group around you of people who inspire you every day and challenge you every day is probably what helps you move forward. In terms of me, learning, being really happy about failing and being able to, or what people term as failing, but I would say is just exercising something that maybe didn't go quite how you expected, but enjoying that and talking about it. I did an interview when I was 19 about having had an eating disorder and how it changed my life. And she asked me questions that I'd never been asked before, joined pictures together I hadn't thought about, things like my sexuality, my body image, you know, stuff like I hadn't considered were almost external forces. Every time that I speak about something about my life or someone else's, people add a different opinion. And I think that helps you to work out what you really believe.
Mm-hmm. Completely agree with that. It's a sort of understanding yourself and accepting that you have to live in order to be able to keep receiving that. You mentioned being able to be vulnerable. Was being vulnerable a particularly difficult thing for you?
Yes. Yes, and it still is. And it's not in the sense that I find I'm not doing it, but every single conversation I have being vulnerable, or every time I connect with someone and show a little bit about myself, I recognise that I'm moving one step forward, I guess. You shared the Brené Brown talk with me about the power of vulnerability. And there's been countless books that I've read which have said the same thing, that what holds people back from connecting and feeling loved is actually showing who they are, because it's not really true love if they're loving something that's not you. Mm-hmm. So I think eating disorders, there's a huge amount of lying and putting up walls involved in it. Depression is often about rebuilding yourself and letting go of all the faces that you've put on to try and hide how you were feeling. So it's all about putting up different faces and hiding behind something. I think vulnerability is the key to everything. And I think it's something that I'd like to hear more about. Definitely.
Not being able to be vulnerable is obviously a massive barrier to being able to get better. You must have struggled seeking help. Was there anyone in particular who helped in your recovery? And what did they do to help in that recovery?
I'm going to give you another very broad answer and just say there wasn't one person. I have connected with so many people over the years, and I'm still connecting with people that contribute to that. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm well recovered. Recovery just means that you don't fit those criteria anymore. It doesn't mean you're not constantly learning, and you're constantly reminding yourself of not going back into old patterns of behaviours and so on. And I don't mean huge, you know, old patterns of behaviours. I don't feel at risk of self-harming anymore and so on. But even the little things, the little white lies that you tell, or the times that you change in outfit before you go out for the day because of what someone else thinks rather than you. You know, it's the tiny little things that are still changing. In terms of people, everyone that I've interacted with have contributed in more ways than one, particularly the people that have taken me into their fold. And for me, there's that little self-critical bit that's gone, I don't know why. But I also know why, because there must be a reason that they've kept me around. And I trust that. So the people, the families, former partners' families, my friends now, my family, who just loved whatever, had that unconditional love for who I am, that's been everything. They've shown compassion, and they've laughed, and they've just continued to do that no matter what I've done. That's invaluable. And also followed all the dips and troughs and weird things that I've done, and places that I've been, and odd things that I've said or decided that I want to do. They've just sort of rolled with it. And that's awesome.
people just accepting you for who you are. And I think that's the greatest treasure that anyone can ever bestow anyone. And have you identified any sort of underlying causes to why your mental health took a turn for the worst?
I think there are a million causes. Personal to me, there's an element of our family dynamics were not always present because my parents worked all the time. I spent a lot of time either at school or doing activities because they weren't at home. And from what I've learned over the last few years, from my mum being very unwell and her recovery and how what she's been able to overcome in her life way before I was even existing, I think the underlying trauma she went through and the effect that that has on your relationships around you, there's family patterns and they repeat themselves if they're not recognised. So those family patterns of difficulties in understanding relationships and forming attachment definitely contributed. And in no way that is that anyone's fault. That's just the way it is. We are a product of our upbringing as well as our genes and genetics. And we know from epigenetics and so on that that really does have an effect from a very, very young age, from the moment that you're born, really. And even when you're in the womb, I would say, and what I'm probably coming to terms with at the moment, and have been for the last few years, is probably identity and how people view identities. I've always been incredibly fluid in how who I like, the activities I like doing, what I like to speak about, what I like to spend my time doing. I love going out dancing and having a laugh, but equally I really like how, you know, reading a book. I love spending time around lots of people. I really like spending time alone. I have always questioned when I was younger the fact that I liked men, I liked women, I liked anything in between. I liked wearing baggy cargo shorts, I liked wearing lipstick. It's one end of the spectrum to the other and all the way around, like a globe. So I suppose the underlying issue for me was the fact that no matter what label you gave me or someone said, oh, is it like this? I went, no, it's like that and so much more. Mm-hmm. I still hold true to that belief that I think people are so much more complex than they even know themselves and have so many more likes and loves and maybe dislikes than they know about. But because we are fit into boxes and because of the societies we live in, they don't often get to explore that. Yeah, that's a broad societal root of it, but mm-hmm. I think that did have a big effect, and I for some reason that affected me more than it maybe affected others at the time.
Mm-hmm. We touched on this earlier, but do you believe in recovered?
I think clinically you have to have a measurement for someone to be safe enough to be independent and start to make their own choices without any guidance or safety nets. In terms of recovery, it's so individual to every person. As I said, I think I'm recovered in the sense that I don't have those behaviours anymore. I think I don't exercise those behaviours anymore, ever. I run the other direction if I see myself pulling into those patterns. And that's the essence of recovery for me. But I think you're constantly growing. And I'm sure I'll look back in 10 years' time and realise that I'm so much further ahead. And I can't even imagine being 10 years further ahead right now. But I bet I will be. And I'll have so much more knowledge and understanding of myself and others. So I think you're just constantly evolving. And there'll be something else. There'll be another big challenge. There'll be another big dip in my life because there always is. And they're always there. So you might have recovered from one thing, but there's something else around the corner. So you're just evolving, I think.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That also takes away that sort of this was a bad period. This was a good period. If you didn't have the bad periods, you wouldn't have the good periods. And if I hadn't done all that bad stuff, I never would have been where I am now. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to say now, but that process didn't lead to recovery. It just led to me being different mm-hmm. to where I was then.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. I think you can't unlearn the things you've learned. And so as long as you're continuing to strive towards learning and put yourself in that mindset, it gives you a lot more to buffer against anything that you might end up experiencing, any kind of trauma, any kind of setbacks. But personally, I'm not sure I would go backwards in a way. And I see the red lights and want to move the other direction. I think that's because of the things that we have learned in our lives. So on that sort of theme of learning, are there any particular lessons or anything that you learned since your recovery that you are worth sharing?
Speak. the most simple thing that I think people can do is speak honestly and speak about what they truly believe. I watched a brilliant TED talk recently by Clint Smith, I think his name was, and it was a poetry. It was called The Dangers of Silence. It was beautiful, and it just sort of pointed out how when you don't speak about something, you know, you're feeding into something else without even realizing it. My biggest problem was I listened a lot and I took in a lot, but then I never recycled it and made it my own. I'd say to anyone, I'd say speak and don't be afraid to do that. Speak and keep speaking, no matter if it feels bad, no matter if someone laughs, no matter if 80% of people out there don't agree with you, keep speaking, no matter what, because that's what you feel is true. And that's you only have one life, you only have you can't control anyone else. Mm-hmm. So you might as well make yourself happy, and in that the people around you start to speak up about what they want, and they feel happy to do that and confident to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if you could, what would you say to your younger self now?
Exactly that.
Same thing.
What would I say to my younger self? Oh, it's so easy in hindsight. Oh, I'd tell her not to eat a loaf of bread and butter just because she wanted to. I'd tell her to split that over 2 days and then enjoy it with both Biscoff and chocolate spread, because that's the best combination. I would tell her to go and do the thing she'd always wanted to. I put off years not going and doing pole dancing because of what people thought. Mm-hmm. For years, I shaved the hairs off my legs. I didn't cut my hair short. I didn't do things instead of doing things. So I tell her to go out and do stuff. Do it all. Do the things you want to within the capabilities of you and within the resources you've got. If I was talking to someone else, it would be, if you have an opportunity there, as long as it doesn't cause huge harm to yourself or someone else, go and do it. Mm-hmm. Make it happen, because you might only get that opportunity once.
Sound advice. Okay, so what do you do on a day-to-day basis now that helps with your mental health, or habits that you think are good to keep you in a balanced state of mind?
Ooh, exercise. Do sport. Get your body moving. Dance. Even if it's just dancing around my room, doing circuits, running. Yeah, anything that gets your body moving, because then you get out of your head. You know, what goes on in your head is wonderful, but your body primarily does need to work, and it needs to move, and it needs to be oiled. Your muscles need to be working to be able to be put to good use when you need them. I think physical and mental health are so intertwined that anything that helps one will help the other. That, and if you are feeling like you're struggling, it's speaking out. I know I messaged you the other day when I had a bad day, and just that acknowledgement of knowing that someone had knew that I was having a bad day and was there if I needed, that was enough. Sometimes that is enough. It's changing, coming outside of yourself, going to that third person perspective for you to go, oh, actually, you know, things aren't so bad. This is just one more day. There's so many things that you do that improve your mental health, even without realizing it. But I think exercise and people are the two things that I'd recommend to anyone.
Mm-hmm. I, again, would completely agree with that. They're saying that exercise is more effective on people's mental health than any kind of prescription antidepressant. Connecting with people is just so vital. It doesn't matter what it is, even if it's just to vent, or if it's just to, you know, just to say, hey, what you've been up to. I think that really, really helps. You kind of translate something that you didn't know you needed. And sometimes it is just your mate, like, suck it up. And I'm like, okay, I needed to hear that.
Yeah, they're the best mates.
Yeah, literally.
The ones who know when to say that, pure honesty. Yeah, no, you're so right. It's those connections and having people around you that know the right language, that aren't going to just sit there and go, oh, that's really shit. Actually, sometimes you need people to turn around and be like, well, actually, maybe you caused that, maybe you could do something different.
100%. The mates that you can call you out on your own bullshit are gold. I completely agree. Do you ever worry about going backwards or regressing?
No, and that's not because I haven't had periods where they're difficult, but I trust myself enough. I've got huge faith and access to far more than I did when I was unwell. Far more of myself. I've got so much more knowledge. You know, that's not to say that it couldn't happen, but I think the people around me and me, we know how I am when I am well. To be able to pick up on the signs early. Things can manifest and people can change. And as I said, there are always challenges, but I think I would deal with them in a better way now. I was a kid, and when I look at it, and I didn't actually have the capabilities at that point to reflect on what I was going on what was going on inside my head and externally, whereas now I have that ability. So I hope that what I've learned and what people have taught me will sort of guide me through in that sense.
Do you ever feel like your sort of childhood was robbed a bit because of everything you went through?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think robbed. I think maybe scrambled, like splattered on a wall. So rather than fit between the lines, I think I'm still living my childhood. Mm-hmm. I know that what motivates me is being, having fun and being playful and imaginative and creative, as well as getting shit done. So as soon as someone wants to do something that's fun and, you know, rolling around on the floor, you know, the other day someone asked me what a teddy bear roll was, and rather than trying to describe it, I just got down and did it. And I realized that I haven't done that since I was about 6 years old. I haven't done that since I was a kid. And I love it just as much as I do now. So no, I don't feel robbed. I think I'm still living it.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I'm still living my childhood. That's incredible. Beautiful, beautiful words. Often people with eating disorders are so aware of the harm that they're doing themselves. So they know better, but they're still wrapped up in it and they still persist. Why do you think that is?
I think, as I said, it's that fog. I think particularly eating disorders, you're starving your brain. Your brain is just not at capacity. You don't have the capability to see where you are and to consider things. All I thought about was keeping warm. People don't tell you about that. They don't tell you how cold you are all the time. When's your next meal? How do you hide something? And functioning and putting on a brave face, those are the only things you have the capabilities of thinking about. There's an amazing, if anyone is interested in that side of things, I'd recommend reading about the starvation experiment, about a group of men who sort of were fed gradually less and less calories and how they just developed anorexic behaviors just from that, just from less feeding, without any trauma or belief systems behind that. It's anorexia is a behavioral disorder in that sense. Mm-hmm. There are genetic components, there are risk factors, but what persists it is the fact that you get to a point where actually you no longer have control. That's probably the biggest thing that keeps it going. It's also tied into a lot of our societal side of things. So I was a big tumble-easer, as so many people our age were. And I became obsessed with aesthetic. And we still live in a society that's obsessed with aesthetic and obsessed with how things look rather than how that person is experiencing them. So I think the changing in attitudes externally and around you will help pull you out of that. And so being around people that aren't obsessed with that, you know, I'm not afraid to say that I have surrounded myself with people who are fairly comfortable around eating and just eat, and it's not a topic of conversation. I don't do diets. I don't engage with conversations about diets unless that person needs to. Yeah, that keeps things at bay, I guess, and stops things persisting.
Mm-hmm. Do you think culture and modern day society sort of exacerbates eating disorders and mental health issues?
It's so difficult to know because our understandings are different. We know that people, particularly eating disorder behaviours, we know that there's lots of documented cases of particularly women who had a lot of resources restricting their calories and becoming obsessed with under-eating 1700s, 1600s before. This isn't new. And a lot of men as well. That's what's not talked about. But yeah, it contributes. It's definitely idolised in certain areas of the internet. That saying, the internet is also, if you are surrounded by a culture of teenagers, or when you're in your 20s, a culture of women, or when you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, a culture of generations that sort of say, oh, I need to watch my weight, or oh, I'm going to get my summer body, or I'm going to the gym because it's coming up to summer. That does have an effect, no matter what, because it's said enough times that you start to believe it as fact. Mm-hmm. Yeah, ultimately it plays a massive, massive role, but it's far subtler than people realise. It's not as simple as just adding, you know, plus size models or banning advertisements or anything like that. It's not that simple. We need to change everything that we use our language for. Language is so powerful. The words that we say want can stick for years and years and years. So teaching people sort of the importance of what they say to another, yeah, that's going to be the root of it. But that's not even related to body image. I think that relates to everything as a whole.
Mm-hmm. No, very true. Do you think women are particularly vulnerable to this, or are they particularly targeted?
I think women undoubtedly do suffer more from a clinical perspective when it comes to eating disorders. When it comes from depression, men tend to. There's a million reasons why this is the case, and I don't think it's as simple as man versus women, the same way as I don't think anything is as simple as man versus women. The female body has been manipulated and used for so long in cultures that we don't understand the depth of it, and it's very, very hard to get away from that. And it will never get away from it, because ultimately we are a species that survives because we get attracted to each other and the way each other looks, as well as the way we are and act. And I think that's something to be celebrated. I don't shy away from and don't dislike when people go out there and wear very little clothing or enjoy their bodies, as long as they're really enjoying it for the right reasons, mm-hmm. I suppose, or the reasons that are freeing them rather than categorizing them. I think women are going through a massive period of self-reflection, of trying to work out what works for society as a whole, cross-culturally, still allowing for those different beliefs at the same time as also women exercising their own right to decide about their own bodies. It's such a mismatch of knowing what's having the most effect. But I think there is, for men, and I think it's going to come out a lot more in the next 20, 25 years with gym culture, I think there's a real problem there that's not recognised. The reliance on protein and the reliance on using drugs and different platforms to be able to make yourself look a certain way so that that becomes part of your personality, effectively. It's so dangerous, and a little bit like depression will be something that comes about gradually, and we don't realise the effects until it's too late.
Mm-hmm. It's only really now that I'm older realising the influence that that had on me as a teenage boy, you know, wanting to be big and lean and all of that. When it comes to women and a lot of, let's say, the advertising that you see aimed at women, it does all seem to be playing on insecurities and fears. I was listening to a particular podcast. It was saying that a lot of marketing campaigns historically have been made by men to show off women, and this is how they should look like. And obviously there has already a bias skew there with how women are portrayed. It sells a particular body type and it sells a particular image that plays on the fears of women. I mean, obviously from a bloke, very naive point of view, but that's the sort of understanding that I was getting. Does the judgment of other women on women, is there a kind of social judgment there that perpetuates this whole body image and cultural identity?
Undoubtedly. Yeah, it's probably a balance of the both. You've got two, yeah, traditionally men and women's roles have been so different. If you separate them and go, yeah, men were in power, they had these control over these choices of advertisement, of what size cars there are, what uniforms, you know, who were the uniforms made for, who were the houses made for, who were, things were all orientated about suiting men. And then the things that they were seen as frivolous or things that were to do with changing the way you look, that was all aimed at women. That definitely underlies it all, particularly when it comes to, one of the big things I really, really hope is going to change over the next 50 years is brown body hair. Still nuts that we know from the age of 12 to 20, I didn't know what leg hair looked like on me. From the age of 12, I'd never let my hair, leg hair grow past probably 2 weeks, which is insane when you think about it. It's absolutely insane. And frankly, it's just hair. But I'm in a really lucky position to be in a position where I can do that. And that body hair side of things, I get just as many comments from women and men. And a lot of, speaking about it the other day, and one a woman was saying, oh, it's really nice over lockdown to not have to shave your legs, and commented on the fact that sort of I, you know, didn't shave my legs anymore. And she said, oh, well, we can't all be perfect. And that need for that feeling that they want to do that, but don't feel they can, is still prevalent through culture. There's still a lot of women who want to do something but hold themselves back because they know that other women or men are going to judge them or may judge them. So, and I think that crosses men and women. Yes, it's women's role to support people, support other women. It's also a men's role to do that, and vice versa. Women play just as much of a role in subordinating other women, unconsciously, most often, and without realizing it. It's not about intentions at all. Most people don't intend to do mean effects. It's just that societally we say things and we don't think about them, or we just spout out what we've learned already, definitely, and advertisement doesn't help with that.
One thing I've noticed with Gina actually is if I say, oh, you look nice, the compliment will only be accepted if she's wearing makeup. And so actually she deems herself good looking when she's all dolled up. But in my eyes, I can barely tell the difference sometimes. And so I'm like, you look nice. But because she's filtered that compliment through her own judgment first, determines whether or not she's accepting it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just fascinating that you curate your own compliments and your own view of the world that you're getting, but you still have the final say on what you're allowing yourself, which is interesting.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. That, like, filtering what someone says is really important, but then how you filter that in, what you block, you know, the compliments that you block and then the negativity or criticism that you let in just feeds more into the same ideas, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right about makeup. I've had that as well. You know, people say, oh, you look really nice today. And, or, you know, I love it when you don't wear makeup. And I'm like, I am wearing so much makeup right now. How do you not see that? But it's wonderful. It's always really nice to hear someone go, I can't tell the difference. Mm-hmm. Because I think makeup can be a huge artistry, but we're still incredibly indoctrinated to think that we can't look beautiful without it.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Makeup is, I don't know, it's, you know, nice for a special occasion and things, but I think sometimes it almost takes away a lot because the natural beauty is a thing that should be expressed in its own right. I do have a bit of a qualm, shall we say, with makeup, but I think it's a double-edged sword, you know.
Yeah, I think that's healthy. I think questioning anything really that doctors who we are naturally is probably a really good way of putting it. It's not the thing that's a problem, it's how it's used, right? Yeah, people can use it to express themselves. You can love clothing because it's colourful and fun. But when you start using it to police people or make yourself something different, that's when it becomes a problem.
There's kind of like counterculture to your stereotypical model. Now we're getting like plus size models. Is that something you agree with, or what are your opinions on plus size models?
It's amazing. Yeah, as a whole, just seeing more body types out there. Oh my god, the certain brands, I'm not going to say which brands because that's feeding into advertising, isn't it? But yeah, certain brands or certain events are publicizing people that look completely different, and in their natural form, they're not photoshopping, and it's huge. You know, the reason that people get so angry about it is they're crossing health with size and they're mixing these up. We've become so focused on people's bodies we forget that actually what's really important is what's behind that body. Yes, seeing plus size modeling is great. What's more important is you see plus size models in their natural way and they're happy and they're moving normally as well as normal models. Other sizes, it's different skin colors, it's different people with different conditions, different abilities. Anything that's in their natural form, I'm welcome. Yeah. I'd love to get to a point where we don't think of people as plus size models or regular size models or anything, but at the moment, if that makes people feel proud of who they are and allows ownership those bodies and being proud of those bodies, then that's great.
Awesome. Okay, and before we wrap up, what advice would you give to someone who is struggling?
I think if someone's struggling, it depends hugely on the person to what they need at that point, but I think reaching out, speaking about what's going on for them, even if it's just telling one person or saying, I just need you to check in with me. Reaching out is a huge thing. Moving to stay with someone for 2 days or, asking someone to go for a coffee. It's something that gets you out of your own head. It forces you to interact with someone else. Also that you just need to get through this day. Every day, we don't know what happens tomorrow. You know, people have plans. They want to move house. They want to go for this new career. They want to, you know, meet this person. They want to do all these things. But really, you have no control over what's happening beyond what's happening right now. So you just have to get through this next day and then wake up tomorrow and it will be a different day. You will feel differently because you've slept, because your body's allowed to recuperate. Your mind has gone different places when you've been asleep and dreaming. So yeah, you need to just get through this day. And if that is enough, that is enough. You don't need to do any more than that. That's what I'd say.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So we've talked extensively on sort of mental health, your mental health, the wider impact. Are there any books or media that you recommend people to engage in if they're in this kind of way of thinking?
So much.
True. Yeah,
it's endless. How long do you want? Okay, the first one and the one I recommend to anyone is The Body Keeps the Score. It's something that has been instrumental in my understanding of how trauma manifests itself. And when I talk about trauma, I mean anything that feeds into your life and causes you to act in a way that isn't thought about and isn't intentional. But you know, it's written by a psychiatrist who worked with people who maybe experienced abuse when they were younger or people coming back from wars who experienced huge, huge trauma. And then that final understanding of actually people really don't have control over their bodies at that time. And what's going on for their bodies is just as important as what's going on for their minds. And it's the connection between that. It's an amazing book and it's so accessible. So if you're not in that area and you just want to know a little bit more about actually why we do what we do, I'd recommend that. I'd also recommend non-self-help and reflective texts. I think they're amazing and I think they can be so useful, but I think you need a bit of escapism, and whether that's, you know, non-fiction or fiction, it doesn't matter. So something like my go-to is a Ray Bradbury novel or Stephen King is a great, you know, a great writer that just creates worlds that are worlds away from yours, hopefully.
Imagine. Yeah. Oh my God. What kind of world are you living in?
Exactly. Yeah. So if you want someone to, that's why people go into media and they enjoy it, it's escapism quite often, isn't it? It's a form of learning, but sometimes you just want to sit back and relax. Yeah. I'd recommend finding a genre of film, books, whatever, that makes you feel relaxed, and then keep going back to that. Incredible books out there. The Road Less Traveled.
Amazing book.
Incredible book. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would have taken it in so well a couple of years ago.
I agree.
I'm far more reflective now. So it's all about the timing as well. Reading something that's challenging. And I'm talking about books because I don't watch films and I'm not very good with series. To be honest, I can't remember any of them. But books stay with me. So another example would be Jordan Peterson's stuff. I think it's endlessly challenging. Love some of the way he speaks. I love his passion. I disagree with some of his ideas, that's totally okay. Esther Perel is another one. She speaks about relationship, sex, open relationships, cheating, so many things that are taboo to talk about in society and will make you, you know, rage inside. But that's really good because it reflects back to you actually what you really think, and you start to learn. So yeah, any of those, really.
Amazing. I think new perspectives are the king of understanding and learning. Yaz, thank you so much. This has been incredible. Your story is brutal, but I think it's going to help a lot of people. And it's really inspiring that you've been able to share it with us.
Pleasure. Thank you for listening.
No.
My mind went places.
It went places, that's for sure.
Oh, God. Thank you very much.
Amazing. Big thank you to Yaz for that episode. Incredible. I hope we can all take something away from it, particularly about accepting our vulnerability. I think that's so important, and an important lesson that we all need to learn when we're struggling, as that's also a part of who we are. I think, you know, when you accept your vulnerability, it just allows you to acknowledge parts of yourself that you often hide away from or avoid. So strong message there. Also, I will link the books and references from the podcast in the description below. So hopefully if you find out some more information, then there'll be some useful links there. One point I would make on that side of things is if you are struggling with your mental health, definitely reach out, definitely speak to someone, but also explore different concepts and ideas through books, videos, things like that, because it often does help translate your own narrative in a different way. And that can make you unlock a lot of things about yourself and explore your vulnerability. I think it's important to accept all parts of yourself. Anyway, big thank you to Monty as well, who does all the editing for these shows. It wouldn't be possible without him. He's taken Brain Dump to another level. So big thank you, Monty. He's a wizard on the old editing front. Get involved in the Brain Dump group. Really appreciate all the content that people are sharing there. It's great to see how many different ideas are floating about. Until next time, bye.